You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, more companies in the United States are looking to make the move to a four-day work week. We'll find out how common the practice is and what the benefits and drawbacks might be. Now, state environmental officials are investigating a spill at a frac sand mine in west central Wisconsin. Discoloration in a local creek was spotted in the town of Curran in Jackson County this past Saturday. And now local officials want to know what chemicals may have been in the spill water and what cleanup efforts will look like. Rich Kramer is a reporter for WPR based in Eau Claire. Rich, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Rich, what do we know about the spill so far?
Well, we know that there was some sort of a breach from the Wisconsin Proppants-owned mine, which is in the town of Curran in Jackson County. This is just north, like right up against the town of Hixton. And basically, some people saw that one of the creeks had changed color, and they suspected that it was coming from the industrial sand mine. So there was a report to the DNR. Someone called the DNR and alerted them. And the company also alerted the DNR over the weekend as well.
And so residents noticed the discoloration in the creek this past Saturday, but do we know when the spill might have actually occurred?
That's still kind of up in the air. I haven't heard anything since. All I heard was the town board chair, Dwight Swenson, told me yesterday that he first heard about it Saturday morning. So it could have been Saturday morning. It could have been prior. That's all I know.
You reported that the spill got into the Curran Cooley Creek. What is that creek connected to as far as, you know, what watersheds it's part of?
Sure. The Curran Cooley Creek is a Class 3 trout stream, so it's not among the state's highest quality trout streams, but that feeds into the Trempealeau River, which is a Class 2 trout fishing area. And, of course, the Trempealeau eventually flows into the Mississippi and on down to the Gulf.
And so these waterways that were directly affected or are connected to the Curran Cooley Creek, what kind of uses do we see those waterways being used for?
Well, the Trempealeau River is pretty well used for fishing. It's also a canoeing, recreational sort of a thing. I'm not so sure about Curran Cooley Creek. The pictures that I've seen from the town board chair, the creek is pretty small, very narrow channel, kind of in a marshy area.
And what can you tell us about the company that owns the mine where this spill is thought to be coming from?
Sure. Wisconsin Proppants is a company that was, this mine in particular was formed around 2014, and it's owned, its parent company is Schlumberger, which is the world's leading, you know, biggest oil field services provider. So they're a company that is also in states where they're having all this drilling for oil and natural gas, and Schlumberger is one of the biggest companies that is basically fracking the wells or pumping high-pressure liquids and sands and different sorts of proppants and chemicals to break apart the rock and extract the oil and natural gas.
And you requested a comment from the company. They did not respond, but do we know if they are working, cooperating with DNR officials?
Well, a DNR spokesman yesterday told me that the company has been working with them extensively. They alerted the DNR over the weekend, as I said, but they said that they've been cooperating fully throughout the process. It's still pretty early in the whole thing to know what exactly that means or what they've been doing. And I know that DNR staff were on site. They were testing the sediment that had come into the creek, taking water samples as well. I'm not sure if they've been allowed to test sediment or samples from the site owned by Wisconsin Proppants, but I would assume so.
We're talking with Rich Kramer. He's WPR's reporter in Eau Claire, and he is covering a frac sand mine spill in Jackson County. And, Rich, you spoke to the town board chair of Curran, Dwight Swenson. What did he have to say?
Well, he said that, you know, residents are concerned about what might be in this. He talked about sludge and cake. Cake is kind of an industry term for when they break up the sand, basically they break it up and they pulverize it and they wash it. So they need to get these sand grains are bound together by clays and different minerals, and those aren't valuable to the energy producers. So they basically wash the mud, for lack of a better term, out of it. And they recycle the water because it saves them money to keep using water over and over again. And because of that, all that sediment tends to settle in these ponds and kind of build up. And so it appears, according to what the town board chair told me, that is the material that found its way out and into the creek.
And this region had a frac sand mine spill just last year. Is that just bad luck, or is this a common occurrence when you've got frac sand mines?
Well, it's not so common anymore. The site or the spill you're talking about last year was the biggest that I think has happened with regards to industrial sand mining. That was a site owned by High Crush Proppants, and that's in the town or city of Whitehall. In Tremplo County, and they had a situation where a worker driving a bulldozer had gone underwater. It the bulldozer slid into the pond, and the worker was trapped for a couple of hours. So they breached the berm of the holding pond in that case to save this person's life. That released 10 million gallons of that's the company's estimate, 10 million gallons of this process water. Which inundated a valley and flowed, and that changed the color of the Tremplo River for a couple days into a bright kind of a tannish orange. But when the sand mines were first building up around 2011, 2012, you'd see instances where there were leaks. That was generally when heavy rains would kind of overwhelm the construction sites or the stormwater holding situations, but it hasn't happened so often up until last year, and then these are the two most recent.
Well, Rich, thanks for telling us what you know, and we'll definitely be checking back in as the DNR investigation continues.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Rich Kramer, WPR's Eau Claire reporter. He was with us today to talk about the latest on a frac sand mine spill in Jackson County. Coming up, one of Northern Wisconsin's tribal nations will be using a new federal grant to work towards energy independence. We'll talk with two tribal members about the project they have planned. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa will be installing a solar power microgrid on its land, thanks in part to a new federal grant. We'll find out more about the project. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an artist from Kenosha.
People attending Comic-Cons can expect to meet their favorite comic book creators, hear talks from famous actors in popular sci-fi movies and TV shows, and dress up in cosplay. And no convention is complete without a wide range of vendors filling booths and booths of stuff. They're selling everything from boxes of comics to Star Wars figurines to swords. One Wisconsin vendor who's become in demand at Comic-Cons is Gingy Girls. Victoria Davis brings us the story behind the artist creating mugs and selling them across the country.
In her at-home basement studio in Kenosha, Sunshine Levy sandblasts beer steins, wine glasses, and coffee mugs. It's a lot of tedious work with some very heavy machinery.
If your hand wavers, if you move a little too quick, you're going to get a bumpy effect and not the smooth, nice cut or the nice straight lines that you want.
On the stairs, there's a box of shot glasses etched with pop culture references.
Yeah, that's Game of Thrones?
That's Game of Thrones. That's Stark. That's with all of his little fur pieces. And then
Sailor Moon
and Serenity. And I'm only using 1.8 inches squared here. It's a lot of detail.
Levy's designs are all her own. While she takes special requests, it's the TV, comic, and film fandom Levy is most known for.
I am a nerd. I'm a geek. I'm a proud one.
Her etches of Harley Quinn, Star Trek, The Goonies, and countless others got Levy noticed by Renaissance fairs and Comic-Cons across the U.S., she's now sold thousands of pieces.
You know, I think I'll blast out a mug or two and see if they sell. It's amazing where my life is like gone from there.
Levy's business is called Gingy Girls Art. She named it after her and her 9-year-old daughter, Danielle.
Gingy Girls was born because I'm a strawberry blonde and she's definitely a little redhead.
When Levy gave birth to Danielle, the doctor said her baby would never walk and likely wouldn't talk.
She's my little miracle.
But despite being born with cerebral palsy, OCD, ADHD, and sensory disorder, Levy's daughter is walking and talking just fine. And it was because of that smart little girl that Levy found her artistic calling in life.
It gets loud.
Sandblasting.
I woke up one day and I said, okay, today's the day I'm going to learn to sandblast. Today's the day I'm going to learn to etch. And that was it.
When Danielle was born, Levy was working for a local healthcare company. Her daughter's physical therapy was a hefty time commitment. And when Levy asked her superior for time off,
I was told no. I was told that if I thought that my daughter was more important than my job, then that's where I should be. And they bought out my contract.
Levy says the experience left a bitter taste in her mouth. So the following year, she took her artistic hobby and turned it into a full-fledged business. This is a passion Levy has also passed on to her daughter.
My daughter is just enamored by everything Star Wars. With her OCD, she had to keep rewatching all the Star Wars films in a row, which is why DR2 came about, because I would sit there and watch it over and over and over again.
The DR2 mug is Levy's favorite creation.
Look at it and you see R2-D2. And then when you take a step back, you see the Death Star and you see the planet Alderaan and you see a fighter and an antenna in there and you actually see Princess Leia on her speeder.
Levy's work has won her awards and introduced her to a number of famous artists. Still, Levy says her greatest reward has been watching Danielle fight for her own dreams.
She falls down more than other kids, but she gets back up. And that's what's truly important in life for any of us, is that when we fall down, we get back up.
That story about Sunshine Levy and her business, Gingy Girls, came to us from Victoria Davis. Levy is currently traveling, selling her mugs and glassware at Comic-Cons across the country. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the Federal Office of Indian Energy recently awarded $39 million in grants to Native American tribes around the country to help build renewable energy projects on tribal lands. One of the recipients is Northern Wisconsin's Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. The grant will help the tribe install new infrastructure as it works towards a future of energy independence. We're joined by two tribal members now. Daniel Wiggins is an air quality technician with the Bad River Band, and Dylan Jennings is a tribal council member with the Bad River Band and the public information officer for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Dylan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having us.
And Daniel, good to have you with us as well.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, the Bad River Band is one of the recipients of these energy grants from the Federal Office of Indian Energy. Dylan, what does the tribe have planned for the grant?
Well, you know, first of all, the Bad River Nation is, you know, as part of a lot of the work that we've been doing over the last few years, we're looking to secure energy independence and become more self-sufficient and self-sustaining. And so this particular project, which Dan is actually our project manager for, you know, he can go into further depth. But what we plan to do is set up a solar system to help power our health and wellness center, our clinic.
And how does this grant and what you're planning to do figure into the overall energy picture for the tribe, Danielle? Is this going to have a big impact?
Yeah, and I think Dylan touched on it a little bit. I think some of the initial goals the tribe has outlined in the past is just exercising the tribal energy sovereignty, and then also applying that to like economic development and providing energy education. So this is just like the first phase of kind of reaching that ultimate goal of tribal energy sovereignty. And Dylan touched on the clinic, but we have actually identified three buildings within this grant project, the Health and Wellness Center, the Wastewater Treatment Plant, and then the Administration Building, the Chief Blackbird Administration Building. So a very, very great project for the tribe.
It sounds like the energy independence aspect is a big part of this. Will there also be financial savings over time?
Absolutely. You know the financial savings are great, and it's one of the outcomes. But you know, from generating 658,000 of kilowatt energy, you know, we're also not extracting 483,000 pounds of coal each year. you know, something equivalent to that. But the projections are around $900,000 in the next 20 years we'll be saving.
And these grants that are being dispersed are focused on green energy. It sounds like using renewable resources instead of, as you said, that coal is a real priority for the tribe. Can you talk a little bit, Dylan, maybe you can start, about why that is a value for the Bad River Band?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as many times, you know, tribes are painted in different ways, but we are not, you know, anti-oil or anti-energy. We firmly realize that, you know, we need to be doing our part in adapting to, you know, better and more efficient ways of living and that are healthy for the environment. Now, even if it means, you know, we have to direct more funding and resources towards these initiatives. And so, like, you know, Dan was, you know, kind of alluding to that, you know, solar energy and some of these renewable projects might be a little more expensive up front, but and it might take many years to recoup some of those costs. But, you know, overall, it's about the notion of energy sovereignty and leaving this place a little less impacted for generations to come. And it ties directly into our tribal strategic plan that, you know, we've created and what we're trying to move towards.
Daniel, would you like to add anything on that about why renewable energy is important for the tribe?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just extending off of the strategic plan in part. You know, the tribe has identified specific goals, and we kind of touched on one of them, which is exercising tribal energy sovereignty. But to be more specific, the tribe has actually identified other goals. For example, reduce energy costs compared to current baseline by 10% by 2025, and then also generate 10% of the tribe's electricities with renewable energy technologies by 2025. So again, this project is just kind of phase one, I guess you can call it, for the overall goals of the tribe.
We're talking with Dylan Jennings and Daniel Wiggins of the Bad River Band about some grants that were received by the tribe to increase green energy production. And climate change is affecting a lot of aspects of life in Wisconsin in different ways. On your tribal lands, are there specific environmental issues that you're seeing that are a cause for concern that employing more green energy could possibly help with?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people in the area are familiar that, you know, in 2016, we had a very catastrophic flood event, you know, which, you know, threatened a lot of our community's access to, you know, even access to the nearby towns and, you know, really impacted some of our tribal budgets. And, you know, I think it was devastating to be without power for so many days, especially for our tribal elders and community members that, you know, really needed it. And so, you know, as we move forward and we're seeing more of these kind of, you know, catastrophic environmental events that have been happening, you know, more and more frequently, you know, we're really looking to be able to provide and sustain ourselves in a good way. So, you know, that's really, really one of the major things that we're seeing. And in addition, there's a lot of, you know, our community is, you know, predominantly undeveloped in a way. We have, you know, 124,000 acres of land within our reservation. And, you know, we're really looking to help preserve everything that's here. And you know, this is an exact way, you know, a direct link to preserving.
And we've talked a little bit about environmental impact. We've talked quite a bit about the energy independence, energy sovereignty. Is this also going to be an economic benefit, not just to tribal members, but to people in the surrounding communities who may be working on these projects?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that the tribe always is interested in is education. Education of facilities and maintenance staff, but also education to the tribal people. One of the first things renewable energy projects need is the understanding of energy efficiency, and that energy efficiency is far more useful than just applying solar stuff. So getting out the education behind, you know, using energy appropriately and in right places is very valuable. But then also just the idea that solar works in the area and works with tribes, you know, is just another big impact, you know, that really homeowners and just neighboring tribes and neighboring municipalities can look at and say, hey, you know what, this works for what they're doing.
And before we let you both go, this is obviously a big influx of support, financial support for this renewable energy project. Are there other parts of that strategic plan that you referred to that will even further advance the commitment to energy sovereignty and renewables?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, this is just phase one of, you know, the ultimate idea of tribal sovereignty and independence. So we're already identifying and looking at new infrastructure that's being built and making sure that it's, whether it's solar ready, they're making sure they're energy efficient and making sure that they're designed properly for the area. So we're applying a lot of what we're doing now, and we're making sure that a lot of the infrastructure is either being looked at, or if it's new, making sure that it's being built properly and being, you know, be ready to be incorporated into the ultimate system.
Well, Dylan and Daniel, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Hey, thanks for having us. And on in a closing note, you know, I think ultimately we hope that we can inspire others to make similar decisions. Like Danny was saying, if a humble nation like ours can dive into solar and alternative energy, then any community should be able to make those same strides.
Thanks to Dylan Jennings and Daniel Wiggins for joining us. Dylan is a tribal council member with the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and Dan is an air quality technician with the tribe. They talked with us about plans to install a new solar microgrid with the help of a grant from the Office of Indian Energy. Also helping out with the project are MU Grid Analytics, Madison Solar Consultation, and Shawamigan Bay Renewables. Coming up is the 4-day work week, the way of the future. A workplace expert weighs in and will ask what you think. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on the morning show, researchers at Lawrence University are developing an app to tamp down teenage angst, which is when a child stews over something negative until it consumes them. Kate Archer Kent talks with a psychologist about what can help young people in the throes of those negative tendencies and how the app works. That's tomorrow morning at 7 on the Ideas Network. Now, as companies continue to compete for talent in today's economy, some are turning to a concept that's been popular in Europe for some time, the 4-day work week. Advocates for the practice say it can boost productivity and encourage a healthy work-life balance, but it's certainly not feasible for every business and can often create its own set of complications if implemented. Patricia Mullins joins us now to talk about the growing appeal of the 4-day work week and why some companies are pursuing it. She's a senior lecturer on actuarial science, risk management, and insurance at UW-Madison. She's also the author of the book, The Best Work of Your Life. Patty, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
There have been quite a few news stories recently about companies exploring a 4-day work week for their employees. Is this a new thing, or is it just getting more attention now?
I think it's getting more attention basically because there was a very large study done in New Zealand in 2018 where a large wealth management company, Perpetual Guardian, decided that the whole company, I think it was about 250 employees across the country, would go to a 4-day work week as a trial. And they partnered with the University of Auckland and some other researchers so that they could gather data beforehand and afterwards. And to their delight and their surprise, it really increased significantly the worker productivity and worker satisfaction. The employees felt more empowered. They actually got a lot more done because they had to figure out how to work efficiently. They have put out a white paper now that just came out recently on how to do this with tips for other companies and how to make this work. They decided after their trial to introduce it permanently. And employees can opt out if they if they care to. Some people really want a traditional work week. So I think that's important. But they the steps to implement it are also very important, and they stress that.
And we'll definitely talk about that. I wanted to address one thing. There was a question on Facebook whether this meant that people were making less money because they were only working 4 days instead of five, but it's actually four 10-hour days instead of five 8-hour days generally.
Well, that's a good question because it varies. For example, the study in New Zealand, they worked for 8-hour days. So they work 32-hour weeks. But there are, you can do it all different ways. You may work for 8-hour days and get paid 80% time, or you may work for 10-hour days, or there are some places like I think KPMG and Deloitte, the accounting firms, large accounting firms, have offered some flex time where they do it over 2 weeks. So you work like 8 9-hour days, 1 8-hour day, and then you have a day off. So it's kind of over the 10 working days.
So they're all different kinds of
models.
All
over the map. And it's very different if you're working a 4-hour week and only getting paid for a 4-hour week. That would be very difficult.
And so this is something that has been done in other countries, maybe a little more than here. But are there industries in the United States where this is more common than we might realize?
It is more common typically in startup companies, in software development and sales, where flex time is a good incentive to get experienced people, especially. And someone had pointed out in a comment I read with in a white paper, especially in the time when unemployment is lower. When unemployment is very high, you don't talk about this very much because then people just really want a job. But when companies, especially companies looking for highly technical people, people with highly technical skills, they really can benefit from offering this as an incentive.
And is this something of a generational development? Are younger workers today valuing flexibility and seeking that work-life balance more than people of an older generation who maybe were taught more that, you know, your career is your identity?
Right. I think that's true, particularly for young families where they have small children at home, or for younger people who are still developing their skills and they want that day off to have personal development or just in the era where they really crave work-life balance. And I think there are those of us who grew up in generations prior where we worked and we figured it out. You know, we worked a 40-hour week and we figured out how to maintain work-life balance. But it's, you know, it's kind of like the Me Too movement. The times change. And not every parent is willing to say, well, you know, I'm going to work nonstop my 40-hour weeks and just do everything else on the weekend.
We're talking with Patty Mullins right now. She's a senior lecturer at UW-Madison and author of the book, The Best Work of Your Life. And we're talking about a growing movement with some companies and organizations to offer a 4-day work week. And we're looking at the benefits and the possible drawbacks of that approach. And Patty, you said that more advice is coming out for businesses that are thinking of maybe trying this out. What are some of the most important things for a company or an organization to think about before trying it?
Some of the very important things are to try to collect some data on productivity and work time ahead of time so that you can evaluate a trial. And another important issue is to do it as a trial to make sure that you have employee buy-in, that they understand why you're doing this and that it's to benefit the company as well as to benefit the individual employee. It's also important to have a measure of work productivity and to have the employee be the one who in a conference with the business owner or the manager or the supervisor decides what those productivity measures will be. So it's much more beneficial if the employees are really involved in the entire process. And then they feel loyal to the more loyal to the company. They feel less stress because they were part of the decision making.
And you were saying that some companies offer this, but it's up to employees whether they want to opt in or not. It seems to me like that might set up an interesting dynamic if some employees are doing this and others are not.
I think it would. I think it would. Although I think to force people to do a four-day work week probably wouldn't work either. I think just some people are, their lives are set up to work 5 days a week and they don't want to do it any differently. We do know, however, that people are not productive for 40 hours a week. Most people, if you ask most people, could you do your job? I mean, how many hours would it take you to do your job in a day? And studies that have looked at that have found most people say less than 5 hours out of an 8-hour workday because they're spending time making coffee, chatting to their colleagues, doing administrative tasks, checking emails, all those kinds of things that just take a lot of time, having meetings. One thing that the company in New Zealand did was they changed meetings from 2 hours to 30 minutes. That meeting could not last longer than 30 minutes. And they found that they got done what they needed to get done in 30 minutes.
And it's so it sounds like actually there are some lessons that have been learned from this that maybe could be applied to make people more efficient and to make work more manageable, even if you don't change the work week.
Right, right. Well, you know, one thing I read that was interesting said, instead of paying people just for showing up, so paying people by the hour is essentially paying people for showing up, pay people by their productivity level, by the job. So this is what I need you to get done, and this is how much it's, you know, you're going to get paid for that. And however quickly you do that, that's great. It reminds me of a story that I've never forgotten. It's a recent story about a friend who is working on the Ice Age Trail. And he had a group of teenagers help him. He decided, you know, it was so much work to cut brush and burn it and do all this stuff, which is hard work, but it's too much to do for him to do himself. So he had this group of teenagers come out, and he said, oh, it was so hard to get them to do anything. They were just kind of, you know, oh, it's too hard. I don't want to do this. So he thought, okay, I'm going to say this is what we're going to get done today, and as soon as you're done with that, you can go. And he said they worked so hard and they have continued coming back because they just know, okay, this is the goal for the day. When I'm done, that's it.
Wow. We had some really interesting comments on this on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Caitlin on Facebook writes, it really is great and makes a big difference in life balance having the option of a 4-day work week. She said, my husband and I have worked every kind of shift and the 4-day work week was really the best. On the other hand, Tracy on Facebook wrote, while I like the idea of it with school-aged kids, it's sometimes hard enough to get them to school and get home, do homework, make dinner, and so on without my day being longer. And that comment from Tracy is really interesting because it seems like you could not, well, I guess you could make the change to a 4-day work week just within your own company. But if all of the other things that people rely on in their lives aren't also accommodating that, that could be really difficult.
Yes, especially if you have a 4-day, 10-hour-a-day work week. One company I know of works 6:30 a.m. to 5, 4 days a week. Now, that would be very difficult for people who have children or who are caring for elderly parents or who have other obligations. That's a difficult schedule. So when you think about a 10-hour-a-day, that can be very difficult. I think really the ideal that we're talking about is a four-day-a-week, 8-hour days, and having the same pay rate. And that's what is necessary for increasing productivity.
We also talked about the issue of transportation, and maybe if you're driving, that puts you outside of the big rush hour, so maybe that's a good thing. But if you're relying on public transportation, that also puts you outside the higher rate of buses or trains or whatever it is you're relying on. So transportation could also be an issue.
It can be a big issue. Transportation, schooling, doing all sorts of other things in your life, administering your life and your family is very difficult outside of those regular hours. So I think that's been a very difficult thing. Now, some people are accustomed to that. We talked a little beforehand about nurses, long-distance truck drivers, warehousing people are used to like three 12-hour days. But again, they've had to restructure their lives. It would be very hard, I think, for a single parent to do that. But if you have a spouse who can take up the slack at the at the other times, that can really work.
We're talking right now with Patty Mullins, a senior lecturer at UW-Madison, and she's author of the book, The Best Work of Your Life. We're talking about the move among some companies and organizations to a four-day work week and the benefits of and possible drawbacks of that approach. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you work in a job that allows for a four-day work week? If so, how does it work for you, and how do you feel about it? Do you feel more productive, or do you feel like you have a better work-life balance? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about the four-day work week with Patty Mullins. She's a senior lecturer at UW-Madison and author of the book, The Best Work of Your Life. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How would you feel if your company moved to a four-day work week? Would that benefit you? Do you work in a job where that possibility would be, well, impossible? And if so, are there other options that would make it easier for you to have a healthy work-life balance? What questions do you have about what a four-day work week looks like in real terms? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. And Patty, when we talk about four-day work weeks, it seems like often it's easier for a white-collar type job versus blue-collar work. Is there a certain class element here that should be part of the discussion?
Important to think about is that there are many people who are happy to have a job and want to work as many hours as they can. We just think about all the people now in this country who work two or three jobs just to put food on the table and to keep their children in clothing and pay their rent. So it's, you know, it's a real luxury to be talking about the four-day work week. For most of us, that would be a big luxury. So we have to remember that it's, you know, it's a very specialized niche in the employees in certain kinds of businesses who would benefit from that.
Let's go to the phones, and Tom in Madison is up. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon. I'm working a four-day work week this week, four 10-hour days. I mix it up a bit. Some weeks I'll do 5 8-hour days. Some weeks I'll do 4 9-hour days and a 4-hour Friday. And some weeks I'll do 4 10-hour days. This gives me the flexibility I need in my life for medical appointments and just things that come up. But I would like to extend the metaphor here. This leads to increased productivity. I'm grateful to my employer that I can do this. I get my work done. If I have to stay late, I stay late and get it done. But we have holidays here, Columbus Day, Veterans Day, President's Day, that are federal holidays. Every state should have those as well. If people get that extra time off, we're not losing any productivity during those weeks. And by God, everybody needs that extra time off, too.
Thanks, Tom. And Patty, it sounds like for Tom, it's even more flexible. It could be for 10-hour days or a regular work week. Is that common where employees can really kind of build each week as it makes sense for them?
I think in businesses that offer flex time, that is much more common, so that you can organize your time around a certain 40-hour work week as long as you get your job done. And it does make people more productive. But Tom brings up a good point. One point in business owners thinking about implementing this is to make sure that employees can still get their required benefits. So if you earn vacation time by hours, if you're going to a 32-hour four-day work week, we still need to make sure that the employees earn the benefits that they're do.
Let's go back to the phones, and Mark in Three Lakes is up. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi.
I guess I've been doing this for, I'm 62 now. I started umpteen years ago, worked for a company that offered flex hours, and I did 3 11s and a 7, which gave me 3.5 days off, started my own business, and that's how I retired.
Thanks for that call, Mark. And so that's another opportunity. People can use that time not just necessarily to catch up on laundry or run errands, but even start their own business.
Oh, definitely. I think it's good for innovation, for entrepreneurs, for people who have another interest, but they still need a day job to make a living, but they want to develop something extra. That's the perfect situation.
Let's go back to the phones, and David in Two Harbors is up. Hi, David.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
I was just going to bring up, it's not, I'm, you know, privy to having a flexible job where I'm in the sales industry, where by Friday doesn't make much sense for me to go to St. Paul from Two Harbors with the traffic going north and all that kind of stuff. So it works good for me. But I was just going to mention that my children have been on a 4-day school week for almost 5 years now, and it's really interesting the money that is saved on transportation for busing on that Friday they have off is tremendous, but it saved the school district from having to pay for the maintenance for the buses. They don't have to provide another meal on Friday. The teachers can actually go to their appointments, and they don't have to pay extra money for substitute teachers.
And we'll leave it there, David. We're a little short on time. I want to make sure Patty can respond. So that's a really interesting thing that the kids are doing well with a 4-day work or school week, and then the teachers are getting a 4-day work week.
That's becoming more common for schools as they try to deal with limited budgets to going to the 4-day work week. But it's very difficult for teachers to get in the amount of teaching learning time that they want in 4 days. So it's, even though schools are going in that direction, and teachers are not necessarily happy about it.
So, Patty, going forward, do you expect the 4-day work week to catch on more in the United States? We have kind of a workaholic culture, but do you think it might catch on more, or is this just kind of the current fad of trying to make work specific jobs more appealing to employees?
I think it will continue. I don't think that there will be an end to it. I think it will continue, but for particular, very particular types of jobs. As I said earlier, for younger people, for jobs that are software development, entrepreneurial startups. And I think not necessarily the 4-day work week as much as flexible time.
And assuming we will have more data, it'll probably show what works best.
Exactly.
Well, Patty, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Patty Mullins is a senior lecturer on actuarial science, risk management, and insurance at UW-Madison. She's also the author of the book, The Best Work of Your Life. She joined us to talk about the 4-day work week and why more companies are pursuing it as an option for their employees. And you can still weigh in over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Have you had experience with a 4-day work week or a completely flexible schedule? How has that worked for you? Do you feel like you're actually more productive even if you're working longer days? Are you building up more loyalty to an employer when you have that flexibility? Or are you in an industry that you think would not be able to do that? Are there other options that would make you more likely to stay with an employer or in a particular kind of job? You can weigh in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, while the Mueller investigation is over, there are still dozens of other inquiries into the Trump campaign, his foundation, and more. We'll find out what's still pending, who's involved, and when they might be resolved. And the Wisconsin Glow was undefeated in its first season in the Global Women's Basketball Association. We'll talk with a coach and a player about their inaugural season. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow after 6 for Happiness Happens Day, Kate Archer-Kent and her guest look at the importance of taking happiness seriously, as well as why it's important to celebrate moments of happiness rather than telling people how to be happy. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then what will it look like when media giants Gatehouse and Gannett merge? We talked to a journalism professor about the impacts nationally and right here in Wisconsin. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret, who will be back tomorrow. This is Central Time.